often do we go through our days living our lives with nothing in particular going on or everything going on, and then suddenly a diagnosis of one thing or another changes everything? Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer. Welcome to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest is going to help us wade through the range of emotions that can be experienced with what is still a frightening diagnosis, a cancer diagnosis, a cancer diagnosis for a child. I would like to welcome Dr. Grace Mucci, who is a board-certified pediatric neuropsychologist and coordinator of the neuropsychology program at Children's Hospital of Orange County in California. She is also the co-editor with Dr. Lilibeth Torno of the Handbook of Long-Term Care of the Childhood Cancer Survivor, which seems like, quite frankly, it's the book that every clinician who's working in this field should have on their desk or at least close by on their bookcase. Dr. Mucci, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's certainly an honor and my pleasure.
Well, you just heard me describe what for many people is a life-altering, devastating, worst-case scenario, cancer and cancer of a child.
Yes.
What's the first thing that you would like for patients, listeners, potential clients to think about when they hear the words childhood and cancer in the same sentence?
Well, I think the first thing for, especially for parents to think about is that while this can be an extremely devastating and stressful thing to hear that your child has cancer, my hope is that they would be able to be somewhat comforted in the fact that, number one, they have a team of physicians and healthcare providers who are working tirelessly to ensure that their child is given the utmost care and attention so that they can recover from this and beat this cancer. So that's number one. And number two, that there are so many new advances in cancer research now that the survival rates for childhood cancers are so much greater than they were even, 20, 30 years ago. So there's a lot to be hopeful about. And so I would just hope that they would be comforted in knowing that people are on their side, that we are doing everything we can to get their child into remission and into survivorship, and that there's a lot of hope.
You heard me introduce you as a board-certified pediatric neuropsychologist. What does all of that mean? That sounds like a long business card.
It does. Basically, what it means is that neuropsychologists are first and foremost clinical psychologists. So they are trained. That's what most of our degrees are in, clinical psychology or other types of psychology, but primarily clinical psychology or counseling psychology. And then licensed as a psychologist in their state, although there's a few exceptions to that. But for the most part, first and foremost, a clinical psychologist, and then we receive specialized training in neuropsychology, where we are looking into and getting experience in evaluating issues or neurocognitive issues related to some kind of brain injury or insult to the brain or any kind of medical disorder that might have an impact on the central nervous system. So we are trained to not only evaluate neurocognitive processes such as like memory and intelligence and language processing, that sort of thing, but we're also trained to help identify areas that need remediation or that need some intervention, and helping patients and their families to find those resources for them.
So it sounds like if you've got a child who has cancer, let's say, and I know there are other areas that you work with, you definitely want a neuropsychologist on the team because that person's going to be helpful to you in a very broad way because you bring such a broad understanding to the experience. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think that would be wonderful. Unfortunately, in the real world, there's not enough neuropsychologists, number one. And number two, there might be some types of cancers that really don't have such an impact on cognitive functioning. So you wouldn't necessarily need a neuropsychologist, but certainly having a psychologist or some mental health professional who has experience in working with children with cancer or, you know, or working with families going through other kinds of illnesses or grief reactions, that would be very, very helpful. And I think the good news is that most childhood cancer centers have those resources available to families. So at least within the form of a social worker or a psychologist or neuropsychologist. So we do work together as a team to ensure that whatever the child needs, that we can address that. So if they need a neuropsychologist, we can provide that. If they don't need a neuropsychologist, but they need a, you know, somebody to meet with because they're having some anxiety or depression, then that would be available to them as well. So
what formed your interest in this field of working? And as I said, I know there are other areas in which you work, but particularly in the issue of childhood cancer, what created your interest in this area?
That's a great question. And I often ask myself that. And I think it's my journey to this has been interesting. So when I was a teenager, my father was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And during and that time, it was before there was a lot of different treatment options available. And he survived maybe 10 months. It had advanced by the time it was diagnosed. And it was devastating for me and for my family. I was the youngest of five children. And we were a pretty tight family. And it was very difficult for all of us. And my parents had been married, I don't even know, over 30 years. So it was pretty devastating on everybody. So I knew that I wanted to work with something that had to do with illness in the family. And so when I went to graduate school to pursue my doctoral studies, I also had a profound interest in working with children. And I decided, hey, this is probably the best match for me is working with illness, with children who have chronic illnesses. And so that's really where I focused my attentions and my training in. And when I started my internship, which I did at Chalk Children's Hospital many, many years ago, when I did my internship, I worked very closely with the oncology team and also working with children with brain tumors. And it just, it was such an honor, number one, to work with these children and their families. I felt very privileged and I took it as a very, I took it as a very great responsibility, took it very seriously. And I just found myself just really loving these kids and loving the families. And since then, I've seen children that I knew when they were 3 and 4 years old who are now going to college. And it is amazing to me just to see the transformation and their development. And it's just an incredibly rewarding experience. And so I just love it. Truly an honor to work with these families, to for them to open up their lives and allow us to help them through this most difficult journey that they're going through.
You talk about the sense of feeling privileged to be able to work with these families. I would think there would also be at least the potential for a sense of feeling overwhelmed that they're facing so much.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's true. And I'm reminded of when I was in training, I would often come home just like so, you know, it's emotionally draining. Let's be real. It is, you know, burnout, compassion fatigue. These are things that are very real. And for people who work in oncology, that's even more so. So I remember times when I would have to call my husband and say, "Could you please have the neighbor kids come over? Can we go next door to see the kids?" Because I wanted to see kids who were healthy and thriving and had hair. And just because when you're working in it day to day, it does kind of color your perception of things. And so it's very important as a caregiver to try to get back to as normal a life as possible, whatever that is. You know, self-care is very important, and just really being kind to yourself.
Sounds like you're saying that it is as critical not only to the care of the caregiver, but to the people the caregiver is working with, that the caregiver take care of self.
Absolutely. This is a huge issue now, and I don't know if you have, you know, looked into this much, but there is the issue of physician burnout is becoming front and foremost now. And I think the new study that came out about a year ago was that about 50, just over 50%, maybe 54% of physicians are experiencing some level of burnout, and different specialties experience different levels of burnout. So this is a big problem because that can have impact. That can impact, you know, their productivity, their practice, in so many different ways. And so it's really important for us as caregivers, not only medical caregivers such as physicians, but also psychologists and therapists. And we've known for a long time that therapists experience what we call compassion fatigue. So the good news is that we are now finding strategies, and because of the increased awareness, medical centers and medical schools and you know, all different kinds of organizations are coming together and saying, okay, what can we do about this? Not only, it is not just the responsibility of the provider to take care of themselves, which includes, you know, getting good sleep, exercise, having fun, doing different types of yoga, maybe some mindfulness training, that sort of thing. But it also is, that the organization or the healthcare organization has a responsibility as well to ensure that they promote these kinds of strategies and that they offer different programs or, you know, support in that setting to achieve, you know, the goal of self-care. So the good news is that's like becoming a very, you know, a focus now.
And thank goodness, because absolutely, caregivers, whether they are clinicians or non-clinicians, absolutely can find themselves exhausted. And that has a not such a happy domino effect on everyone around them. The emotional reactions of parents when they first receive this diagnosis, would you say that there are typical reactions or no?
Both, if I could say both. I think there is a combination of things. Certainly, you have your typical reactions, which usually encompass some sort of denial. You know, if you go back to the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the grief stages, so you have your typical denial. You know, this isn't happening to me. This is, you know, you're in shock. You just, it's like you're in some other dimension. It's kind of surreal. So you go through that, and then you also get to a point where you're pretty angry. You know, why me? This is not fair. I'm, you know, this is why my child, you know, all kinds of different reactions. And then Usually there is some form of depression, but not all the time. It really depends. And there's a lot of individual factors that and personality factors that go into how much a parent is going to react to it or experience it, what their coping strategies have been throughout their lives, and what they've found helpful. So I would say probably, some anger and maybe even some, certainly some sadness, and those are very common. When you get to some of the more uncommon reactions, if the denial continues to be present, it can interrupt treatment. It can create some conflict, with not following through with recommendations, that sort of thing. So we, at CHOC, and I'm sure at all children's cancer centers, we are very mindful of that and know that these are most often very common reactions and that we just manage it. We deal with it. We provide them with the support they need to come to terms with what's going on and to, again, there's another aspect of trust, and trusting the medical team that they're doing everything they can or they're doing the right thing. And sometimes families have to go get second and third opinions, and that's okay because we want families to be confident in the treatment they're receiving and know that we're all on the same team. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
It does. Do you recommend getting a second opinion?
well, that's I if a family is okay, so I'll answer that from a personal perspective.
Okay.
If it were me, I would get a second opinion, absolutely. And the reason is because you want to make sure that you are fully aware of all the options out there for treatment and that you have full confidence in your medical team and what they're doing. From a medical perspective, I think, most physicians would say that the ones that I've talked to, it's like, yeah, get a second opinion because when you get a second opinion and then you get the same results or similar results, that makes me feel better that, I'm doing the right thing or that we are doing everything we can. So it kind of goes both ways. And from personal experience with my husband had some chronic cardiac issues, we sought a second opinion and it was, crucial for our comfort level and knowing that we were doing everything we could and being able to make those decisions.
We've been talking about the adult reactions to a diagnosis of cancer in a child. I'm wondering the age of the youngest child you've ever treated with cancer.
From a psychological perspective?
Yes.
That's a good question. Let me think about that for a minute. I think, well, I've certainly worked with parents with infants, but I don't consider that of really working with a child directly. I'm thinking that the youngest that I've worked with is about a 3-year-old.
Okay.
Yeah, I've had maybe two patients that are coming to mind that were about 3 years old, and helping them to help to take control over this uncontrollable experience. And these two kids that I'm thinking of, they were going through bone marrow transplant at the time, and so I really just did a lot of play therapy with them and allowed them to, dictate or kind of direct, what they wanted to do, to help provide them with a sense of not only normalcy, which is extremely important, For these kiddos, especially during that time, they were in isolation for a long time. They still are if they go through transplant, but there's been a lot of changes over the years. But helping them to feel normal, be able to have, normal play experiences is very important. So, sure. I remember it was incredible. And there's another kiddo that I'm remembering that was about 7 years old going through transplant, and her play was extremely productive. And as soon as I got into the room, she'd say, "Let's get started." And she would start doing whatever was going on.
Good for her.
You know, if there was, yeah, oh, it was amazing. In fact, when she was getting ready to be discharged and going back to school, we played a lot of school. Teacher, you know, being in the classroom, it was pretty amazing. And I just, she taught me a lot.
Interesting.
She taught me a lot.
Dr. Mucci, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation about the emotional challenges for children faced with their own diagnosis of cancer. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. Don't go away. The emotional reactions and challenges for children confronted with this diagnosis, I'm wondering if they even understand what the diagnosis is.
Well, sometimes they don't. I mean, and that really depends on the age of the child, their level of cognitive functioning, and so forth. So, explaining that to children has to be done on an age appropriate level, and in ways that they can understand. But there is a way to explain it to children of all ages. Certainly an infant, it's much different. If you think about what an infant's needs are, you know, they really need to feel comforted. They need to be held. They need to be fed when they're hungry, that sort of thing. So just comforting them and making sure that they're not, unattended is the most important thing. For like toddlers and so forth, you know, when you explain it to them, the good news about this is that most centers have child life specialists. I don't know, I'm sure you've heard of child life specialists. So these are professionals who are trained in explaining cancer to children of all ages, and they have some incredible tools that they can use. Sometimes it's obviously done in the hospital when they're diagnosed, and it's just, they are very good at what they do. So just making sure that you explain it in terms that they can understand. Like for maybe kids who are like 5 or 6, you know, that there's some kind of a germ or something that they have, or not a germ, but they have to take medication to help, you know, counter this cancer, and that they, you know, while it may make them feel a little sick at first, you know, that they're going to feel better in the long term. So there's lots of different ways that it can be explained, but it does have to be age appropriate. And also explain to them what are some of the things that they're going to need to experience, like when they have to get, you know, their blood drawn or, you know, that sort of thing, that there's a reason behind that, but explain it in terms that they can understand. And then ensuring that you ask them, what do you understand from what we just talked about? Do you have any questions? Really fostering that open dialogue is very important. So I don't know if that, if you have any other follow-up questions on that, one thing I do want to add is that you want to make sure that you let them know that this is not their fault. I think that's a big one, because sometimes children, if something happens to them, they think, oh, there's something I did. Maybe I didn't wash my hands, or maybe I shouldn't have, you know, eaten that, you know, snuck that piece of candy, that kind of thing. So you need to ensure that they know that this is not something they did. And that's really important. And that's important for parents to know too, because sometimes parents often blame themselves for this, and there's no blame. It's just some terrible thing that happens.
You know, I think that we kind of know and think about and recognize the fact that a parent may blame him or herself for whatever is going on with the child. But I don't think we think about the fact that a child might blame him or herself for their own illness. So I appreciate you underscoring that awareness, because it is so important. You've referenced infants a couple of times during a conversation, and it's very hard for a parent, for anybody, to think about an infant actually having cancer.
Yeah, I know. It's very hard to see, but actually there is, you know, in leukemia, the most, I believe, it peaks in infancy and toddlerhood. So there's two peaks, I believe, but so it's very common. It's more common than we think. So it can, yeah, it's a difficult thing to see. But yeah, they. The good news is again, getting back to the research, there's been so much research that has changed the way we treat cancer in terms of the different types of chemotherapeutic agents and how it's delivered and so forth, that has increased the survival rate. So these kiddos are you know, surviving at much higher rates now.
So again, a lot more hope if you find that you have that diagnosis, or someone you cares about has that diagnosis. There's a lot more hope than there ever has been.
Yes, and of course it is. It does depend on the type of cancer and the stage and how early it's caught and that sort of thing. But in general, I believe the overall cancer survivor rates for children is around 90%, and that's taking into account, you know, all the different types of cancers. So it's just around 90%. So that's pretty high. As you know, before my stepson's best friend, when he was in junior high, his best friend had leukemia, and his chances of survival at that point were about 60%, and he had to go through bone marrow transplant. And he unfortunately did not survive, but if he was diagnosed at this time, you know, in terms of what we know now, his chances of survival would have been much greater.
So again,
so we've come a long way.
Absolutely, a very long way. Are there cultural differences in how children and parents react to a diagnosis of cancer? Do you know?
There are. I think yes and no. There's a lot that we need to learn about that. But what we do know is that, yes, there are some differences. And I don't know if it's really how they deal with it, but certainly how they experience the treatment process and how they view the medical community or their trust in medicine. So different cultures may have differing views of traditional or Western medicine, I should say. Some cultures rely more on Eastern medicine techniques, and now they're having to, use more Western techniques that are a little more difficult for them to accept. So there are some cultural differences with that. There's cultural differences in how they communicate with medical teams and physicians. So we always have to be mindful of that and also respect individuals' cultural beliefs, in terms of just how they view medications and blood transfusions and so forth. So there's a lot of factors that can be part of this whole picture of diagnosis and treatment that the medical teams, need to take into consideration.
So it's important not to make assumptions.
Oh, absolutely important. Definitely asking them, what are your beliefs? Do you need to have, different religious, leaders come into the hospital? Do you, we have to be respectful of different belief systems and practices. And because that's ultimately going to, instill a sense of trust in the medical team if they are respectful of, their practices. And so that's going to have profound implications for future medical needs and issues that might come up.
According to the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health, over two-thirds of pediatric cancer survivors will deal with at least one late effect in their lifetime. So my first question to you is, what are late effects?
So late effects are a combination, whether it could be, one or a combination of medical issues. You can have psychological late effects or neuropsychological late effects. So these are, let's take medical effects. So these are things like secondary malignancies or cardiac conditions that are the result of certain chemotherapies or treatment that was received. Or if there's radiation, some of the late effects for that. So these are the, and then in terms of neurocognitive or neuropsychological late effects, so those are like learning disabilities, attention problems, that sort of thing, and psychological anxiety, depression, sleep disorders, that sort of thing. So these are things that typically, I shouldn't say typically because there is no typical pattern, but these things can manifest or arrive shortly after treatment or sometimes years after treatment. So it is variable. And that's why it's important for children who have been treated for cancer, that they are part of a long-term follow-up team that I like to call it surveillance, that they are under surveillance, that they have medical professionals who are aware of these potential late effects so that they can see the subtle or early signs of some of these late effects so that we can nip them in the bud and evaluate them and give them the treatment that they would need to have.
Are there late effects associated with all of the traditional methods of treating cancer?
I don't know if I can totally answer that question because I'm not, a little bit outside of my purview, but I would say that there are kids who go through cancer treatment who don't have any late effects at all.
Okay.
And, there are certain chemotherapies that are particularly notorious for different late effects. Cisplatin is, you know, can be implicated in hearing loss or ototoxicity, because it's particularly toxic to the hearing. So there are certain chemos that are particularly toxic to certain organs or parts of the body, a central nervous system. Some are particularly toxic to the brain. So like intrathecal methotrexate is something that we are concerned about, although it's actually an example of how research is changing how we treat cancer. So this is something that before intrathecal methotrexate, cranial radiation was used primarily and it was delivered to children with leukemia, high-risk leukemia, because they found that the radiation reduced the risk of relapse. And so what they found, though, is that, you know, cranial radiation is particularly toxic to the developing brain. And so they've developed alternative measures or treatments, and one of them is intrathecal methotrexate. Actually, I think that's pretty much the the alternative. And so that's chemotherapy methotrexate that's delivered directly into the cerebral spinal fluid. And so that targets the central nervous system. So no longer do we have to do cranial radiation. I think there's still some exceptions to that. But what we found is that that did reduce some of the neurocognitive late effects, but we still have some. And things like working memory and processing speed and those sort of things are still affected by, that type of intrathecal treatment. But it's not as severe as the cranial radiation was.
Once the cancer treatment is complete and the disease is in remission, I'm first of all, is there ever a time when the cancer treatment is complete?
I think so. I think that, yes. You know, each cancer has a different treatment process. Some is much shorter than others. Leukemia, it's about a 3-year process, but there's intense time so that they're getting much more intense chemotherapy, but towards the end when they're on maintenance, it's much less intense. So I think that as far as administering chemotherapy and or radiation, there is an end to that. Yes.
Okay.
Again, the need for surveillance and long-term follow-up is, you know, extremely important, because if there is a recurrence or if there is a new cancer that develops, you want to get that as soon as possible. So I would say, yes, that there's definitely an end to the treatment. And that's something that we stress when we're talking to parents, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel here. So, this will get better.
It is good news to hear that there is an end to at least that, the treatment. You know, again, mm-hmm. the scary thing, and we'll talk more about it after the break, is that so many of the treatments, it sounds like, do have late effects, and not everyone will be affected, and not everyone will be affected in the same way. But it does sound kind of scary that is a possibility. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue discussing this issue. Ramuchi, we've been talking about late effects as it relates to cancer treatment. Do you find that childhood cancer survivors carry that fear or that possibility into their lives as adults? Is there more trauma that is created for them because of this possibility?
Well, that's a great question. And I would say that that really varies. I think, there's a number of factors that go into that. So if cancer was experienced as an infant or a toddler, you know, in my discussions with survivors, they don't have the same fears that maybe a child who, or a survivor who was, you know, more aware of their treatment as they were going through it would have. But we do know that there are certain risks that that may place somebody at risk for having some psychological effects. So, and also other kinds of neurocognitive effects. So, but in terms of the child or the survivor really carrying that with them, I would say, yeah, there is a risk for them to have some anxiety about, is this going to come back? And that may pop up at different times in their life. Maybe when they have some kind of scare, maybe a medical scare, they might think, oh my gosh, this is the cancer coming back. And then on the alternative, on the other end of the spectrum, you might have somebody who is in total denial of that and is not going and getting their regular care as an adult or their follow-up with their physician. So that's a problem too. So I think you have a wide range of effects there.
You've said in response to many of my questions that it depends on the type of cancer that the individual is experiencing. I'm wondering if there is a type of cancer that is more likely to or less likely to affect thinking and learning.
Yes. So the two cancers that are most that we know are at greater risk for having these, what do we call neurocognitive late effects, are certainly brain tumors. That's certainly the biggest one, but also ALL or leukemia. So we know that they are at the greatest risk for compared to the other cancers. And, you know, the reasons for that are obvious. I mean, especially for brain tumors, you know, depending on where the tumor is located in the brain, depending on the type of radiation they received, how old were they when they were treated, all of these factors go into, you know, what is their risk and also what they had going into the treatment. If they were, you know, a really high functioning or what we call cognitive reserve, if they had fairly high IQ going into treatment, they may come out of that maybe with less, you know, apparent cognitive deficits than somebody who's going into it with maybe a low average IQ. They don't have as much cognitive reserve to offset some of the declines that they might experience. So those are the kids that we worry about the most, are the kids that have been treated for brain tumors. And then, of course, the kids with leukemia, the issues with leukemia is that this is a bloodborne cancer. So there's two major things that probably factor into this. And that is, one, it's a bloodborne cancer, so it does circulate, blood goes into the brain. And so that's why, you know, we're concerned about that risk of relapse is much higher if they don't receive, either cranial radiation or now intrathecal methotrexate, which helps to reduce that. But it's the intrathecal methotrexate and the radiation that can actually create some of these neurocognitive deficits long term. So So those are the things, the two major ones that are affected. And but that doesn't mean that other cancers can't have cognitive effects. I think we just don't really know. It's we think that for the most part, you know, other cancers don't have, you know, they're not at high risk for that, but that can happen. And I've evaluated kiddos with, you know, types of cancers, liver carcinomas, and of course, kids who have gone through bone marrow transplants. So when they receive really high doses of chemotherapy and some, they're looking at combinations of chemotherapies that are delivered, and does that increase risk for cognitive deficits? So there's a lot of research going on into that.
Is the risk for cognitive deficits as great for adults who have newly been diagnosed with cancer as it could be for children, whose brains are obviously still growing and forming in very different ways?
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent question. And yes, there is a difference. Although I do know that there's some new research out for adults going through cancer, and there's been research going on for years in terms of breast cancer and chemotherapy treatment for breast cancer and the chemo brain that has been the term that's been coined has been, you know, cancer patients themselves can tell you very explicitly, this is a real thing, chemo brain. Many of those symptoms go away after treatment, but sometimes they linger. So I don't think we really know why certain types of cancers like breast cancer are more susceptible to that. Probably some of the chemotherapies that they receive that are particularly toxic to the brain. But for kids, you have to take into account their neurodevelopmental stage. So yes. The problem with children is that when they are developing, depending on when they get that treatment, that can have implications for future neurodevelopment. So there's different processes that go on when the brain is developing, and certainly like in teenage years and adolescence, there's an increase in the white matter in the brain. So chemos can interrupt that process, that white matter development process. And white matter is extremely important, and this can happen in children too, but white matter is very important for the effective and fast transport of nerve impulses, so for nerve cells to communicate with each other. And so what happens is that can interrupt or slow down that process, so that affects what we call processing speed. So they're not able to do they're not able to complete tasks as quickly. The math might become a problem because they can't like calculate things quickly. Doing things like timed tests are just not easy for them. So there's a lot of things that can be affected. And like I said earlier, sometimes these things don't show up for several years. And so a child could be done with their treatment, and, you know, 2-3 years go by and now they're starting to have learning problems. We consider that to be a factor of maybe development. So, for example, if a teenager or, you know, if they are now going into junior high and high school, the demands of that curriculum are much greater than it is in elementary school. In elementary school, you have usually one class, maybe a couple classes. You maybe go to another class for something else. But in junior high, you have to switch classes every hour. You have different teachers with different needs, with different personalities. You have to navigate so many different things. And then you've got the social part on top of that. So there's a lot to organize, a lot to take in, and when you have slow processing speed, that can be affected, and that can show up a little bit more when those demands increase.
You mentioned time tests, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to see schools do or you're aware of them already doing to accommodate children who have cancer or a cancer history.
Good question. Yes, so my experience is that schools are very receptive to input from professionals who work with these children. It's identifying them, though, that is a challenge sometimes. In particular, I find that kids who have been treated really early on, so they haven't really been. Teachers don't look at them as, oh, I remember they just had cancer treatment, so I'm going to make sure I give them a little bit of TLC. So, for example, a child who's treated in early childhood starts school out, goes through school, everything's great, but then they get to high school and they start to have some issues. The educational team might not be aware, number one, that they had cancer. And if they are, they may not be aware that maybe that cancer treatment had some impact on their learning abilities or their ability to keep up with the work in class. So it's up to, unfortunately, it's probably up to the parents and the medical team, if whoever is following these kiddos, that they identify that. And like at Chalk, we go to our long-term survivorship clinic and meet with them when they come in. Usually it's like an annual checkup. And ask them, how is school going? Are you having trouble with memory? Are you having trouble with attention? Are you having trouble keeping up? And we also can perform very quick screens on them to see if there's something that is showing up that needs more in-depth analysis, or assessment. Once we identify that, I find that the schools are very receptive to implementing accommodations in the classroom. Such there is a thing called Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and what that does is it provides accommodations such as extra time on tests or being able to sit up in the front row to minimize distractions, maybe being able to take breaks. I haven't mentioned the issue of fatigue, and that is a big thing. That could be something that is experienced long after treatment is done. And so, being able to take breaks, being able to, get up and maybe go to the nurse's office and lay down if they need to get it recharged, those kinds of things. Schools are really receptive to that. It's just, us as professionals, we need to get, and I think we do a pretty good job at Chalk, but that we can always improve, always. And that is identifying kids that are at risk, making sure they get the evaluation, and then making sure that we have the follow-up with the school. And I find that when I go to IEPs or I go to school meetings or 504 meetings or even phone in, take a moment to phone in and educate the team as to what's going on and why this is an issue, they're very receptive to that.
So, is it a reasonable request on a parent's part for their child's psychologist or neuropsychologist to be a part of the individualized education plan team planning? That was a mouthful.
Yes and no. I think that, I would say yes. It's reasonable to ask. You can always ask. The problem is that our resources can sometimes resources can be very limited. I do think that it is reasonable if there has been a neuropsychological evaluation, that they're given a report that has specific recommendations outlined in it that they can then take to the school and the school can run with it. Sometimes, depending on the complexity of the child's history and what their needs are, that might require some additional input. And I would say most neuropsychologists, especially pediatric neuropsychologists, are more than willing to pick up the phone and phone into a meeting or contact the principal or contact the school psychologist to talk with them about what our findings are and what they're recommending. So Yes, I would say that that is definitely reasonable to ask, but being aware that not everybody can do that, it's there's so many factors that go into it in terms of how far they have to travel, getting the time to do that. It takes away from other things that they need to do. So, but it's definitely reasonable to get a report that can help the educational team devise an appropriate plan.
As far as you know, in this particular instance, is testing covered by insurance?
So, for the most part, and you know, I have the fortunate of I'm fortunate to be in California, where we have a supplemental insurance plan for children with chronic illnesses, and cancer is included in that. And I think a lot of states have similar programs. So that program does cover neuropsychological evaluations for children who are at risk for these kinds of issues. So that does cover it. It doesn't, however, having said that, a lot of private practitioners are not able to accept that insurance because of the reimbursement rates are need to be subsidized by, you know, a larger institution. So in terms of, you know, the supplemental insurance, usually that would cover it. And certainly a diagnosis of a brain tumor or ALL does put a child in a different category in terms of having benefits for neuropsychological evaluation, and keeping in mind that psychological coverage is under the parity law, which states that that psychological treatment should be offered at the same with the same benefits as medical treatment. So even if somebody is in doesn't have access to a childhood cancer center where, you know, maybe their supplemental insurance is covered, because not everybody's eligible for the supplemental insurance either, but it's usually covered by their medical insurance.
Dr. Grace Mucci, a board-certified pediatric neuropsychologist, coordinator of the neuropsychology program at Children's Hospital of Orange County, California, otherwise known as CHOC. Thank you so very much for joining us today and sharing all this very important information with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It has certainly been my pleasure, and just a shout out to all of the families and kids and parents who are going through this, just to keep strong and you know, just never give up hope.
And the website for Chalk?
Is www.chalk.org.
Terrific. Thank you again, Dr. Grace Mucci, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And
Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
it has been my pleasure. I was happy to be able to have you back again. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So send me an email. So send me an email, Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.